In his proposed two-year state spending plan, Governor John Kasich has included language that would establish a so-called parent trigger law, permitting parents and guardians of children attending certain schools to close the school and have it reopened as a charter, and that would be among other reform options. To our listeners, we'd like you to tell us if you think parents and guardians should have more say about the operations of the public schools their children attend or could attend. Tell us whether you support ideas like the parent trigger law. Coming up later, we'll talk with Heartland Institute Center for School Reform Director Bruno Berend. He supports such change, and also we'll be speaking with Ohio House Assistant Minority Whip Debbie Phillips, who opposes the parent trigger law. Joining us now is Los Angeles Times staff reporter Teresa Watanabe. She's covered the issue there, and we welcome you to the show, Teresa.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The law was enacted in 2010 in California. How was it intended to work there?
Well, it is intended to give parents a decisive voice in the running of their school, especially schools that are low performing. They were given the opportunity to circulate a petition, and if 51% of the parents sign the petition saying that they want one of four reforms, then the school district is obliged to listen to that and consider it.
There is one school in one district in California that has pursued using this option, and they chose to – they wanted a charter school opened up, correct, in Compton?
Yes, that's correct.
What are some of the other options that they had?
Well, there's four options that are laid out. The first one is to convert to a charter operation. The second one is to close the school. And then two other options would allow for some radical restructuring, including removing the principal and half of the staff and significantly changing the academic program.
What has been the academic response to this in California? In other words, the so-called experts in the state, how have they responded to this?
Well, I think that there has been a lot of confusion and trepidation about this pioneer petition drive, partly because the law itself was not very detailed or clearly laid out the steps and the process. And so Compton's experience was really the first, and the state PTA, for instance, a lot of the teachers' groups, the school administrators' groups, had a lot of concerns that the process as implemented in Compton was not public enough. There were no public hearings. There were no public meetings. The parents were never gathered to be told that this petition process was underway, mm-hmm. or what options they had for change. The process was basically triggered by an outside organization that was allies of the charter school industry, who came in and basically circulated the petition secretly. And they said that they did this because they didn't want retaliation by the district or by teachers who opposed them. But because it was a secret petition drive without any public hearings, it created a lot of controversy, including criticism by some of these stakeholder groups.
My guest is Teresa Watanabe. She's a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. We're talking about the so-called parent trigger law. It's been introduced in the governor's two-year state budget proposal. It would give parents more power in determining the future of their schools if those schools are underperforming. Now, in California, Teresa, how many schools, do you have a sense about how many schools would fall under this category and could face these kinds of challenges by parents?
You know, I believe it's about 75 schools. So it's a very, very small percentage of mm-hmm. schools that are able to do this. And I believe in Ohio, I think I read an article that said fewer than 50 schools in the state would fall into that category. So we're not talking about a huge number of schools. However, the trigger proponents are hoping that they can get that cap lifted in future legislation.
In other words, broaden the category.
Yes. Well, the category itself, is set. Basically, schools that are considered low performing
mm-hmm.
Are eligible, but there's a cap of only 75. So there could be,
okay.
I don't actually know how many schools fall into the category, but only 75. So if there were 100 who were qualified, only the first 75 who were successful in the petition drive would be able to actually do that.
Is it any surprise that this first petition effort in the Compton District was initiated by an outside group? Was that what opponents expected?
Well, I don't think there was any surprise that the petition was triggered in Compton, because Compton
right.
Unified is one of the lowest performing schools in the state, and had been the subject of a withering state audit
mm-hmm.
that found that the adults were putting their needs over the needs of children. I think what surprised people was that an outside charter group, or not, they weren't a charter group, charter ally group, was the one who came in to circulate this. But Parent Revolution, the petition supporters, said that, a lot of the parents themselves didn't even know about the law. They didn't have the wherewithal to know how to go out and get a petition done and circulate it. So they sort of came in to help them. And that without that kind of help, it might not have happened.
Some parents are complaining, though, now that they were not fully informed about what they were signing. They didn't understand what they were signing, and they want their signatures removed from the petitions.
That is correct. And there are many parents who personally told myself and other reporters that they were misled into the nature of the petition, that they were told the petition they were signing was to, quote, beautify the school. They were never told that it would be converted to a charter operation, that they would lose their principal. He's only been there a couple of years, and from most accounts is very well-liked and has made quite a bit of progress. Their test scores have gone up 77 points in the last 2 years.
Wow.
Putting it among the highest rising performances in the state. And so they said that they were misinformed, and several of them, in fact, did rescind their signatures. Whether that's legally binding or not is a matter in the courts right now.
Exactly. It's been pretty much locked up in litigation almost from the beginning. What is the litigation all about, and where does it stand right now?
Well, the petition supporters filed a class action suit alleging that their constitutional rights to free speech and equal opportunity were being violated by the district's requirement that in order to verify their signatures, they had to physically go in with photo ID, and that process was decried as way too onerous by the petition supporters. And a Superior Court judge in L.A. agreed and issued a preliminary injunction against the district for requiring that. The district has not used that since, and the litigation continues as to whether the district's rejection of the petition in February was proper.
Are there other schools or other groups of parents around the state kind of waiting with bated breath for this to be resolved? Is there a sense that there's others that want to move forward with some aspect of the parent trigger law?
There are other districts where parents are organizing. We don't know of all of them,
mm-hmm.
but the San Fernando Valley, City of Carson, and Linwood, which is a suburb, a small town next to Compton. Parents have begun efforts to organize there. Parent Revolution has changed strategies. Rather than going into these districts in secret with a petition, they're basically going in and organizing parents throughout the area. They said that they have many, many parents who are joining their parent revolution or parent union as chapters. And the idea now is to organize the parents and let the parents decide which of the reforms they want to pursue, rather than the first effort in Compton, where Parent Revolution essentially chose the charter option and even chose the charter operator for the parents, put that on the petition, and then went into the district.
One of the criticisms of the charter option is that if you want to do that one-year turnaround, in other words, the next school year, it needs to be operating if the petition is passed and if all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted kind of a thing, is that really only for-profit charter operations are ready to gear up that quickly. And that it favors them.
In terms of the other options, mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that, yeah, it's a very complicated prospect to go in with a different reform and say we're going to have a reform where we're replacing 50% of the teaching staff and get rid of the principal. I mean, parents who don't have a lot of experience in school administration, I think, would be hard-pressed to be able to implement that themselves. Hence the expertise offered by some of these charter allies or these charter organizers. So one of the reforms actually proposed, because this is now also up before the State Board of Education, and there is a new Governor Jerry Brown replaced the State Board of Education with a whole new majority, and they definitely have put the brakes on moving forward with implementing regulations for this law. One of the things that they're looking at is whether to require that anybody who circulates a petition has to disclose their financial interests so that people will clearly know whether you, for instance, are an ally of the charter school industry or not.
Now, a handful of other states, I think it's been enacted in Mississippi or Louisiana, a handful of other states besides Ohio are looking at the idea. How has it spread? It's not an accident that all of a sudden the idea of the parent trigger option has popped up in all these different places.
No, I don't think so. And I know that Parent Revolution has worked with a lot of states, because after news broke last December that they had done this, or that they had actually turned the petition in, and news broke last year when California became the first state to pass this, I know Parent Revolution said that they were flooded with calls from districts or from parent groups from all over the country interested in this. But it wasn't only a local thing. You have high-profile national figures, including Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who spoke favorably of the parent trigger effort in California, and former D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee even came out to Compton and met with parents and has publicly spoken out in support of them.
You know, getting back to the idea of parents and their qualifications for making these sorts of changes, how in the world would a group of parents decide who they're going to replace a principal with and decide who they're going to replace 70% of the teachers with? I mean, is there some structure established for that?
You know, there isn't, and that's been one of the criticisms in California, that this law was cobbled together fairly last minute in order to meet the deadline for the Race to the Top competition, the federal competition. And so if you actually look at the law, it's very, very general, which is why the State Board of Education has had to draft emergency regulations about how do you actually implement this stuff. And those regulations were criticized, and now the new majority on the board is looking at it again. But I think there's a sense that the process has to be spelled out in more detail. But again, the question of who would actually move forward to put in a new reform or a new regulation, tossing out the principal and stuff, I don't think that any of that has actually been addressed yet.
Teresa, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate your help.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
That's Teresa Watanabe. She is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She's talking to us from Los Angeles. And when we return, we'll talk with some proponents and opponents of the proposed parent trigger law in Ohio. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
At the gas pump, Peter Arbogast fills his Honda Civic. He's on his way to his job at the local Honda dealership, and he admits that the production slowdown is the talk of the showroom and the shop.
Obviously, a lot of my friends and customers work out there, and it could definitely impact things.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Showers, there's a chance of showers off and on throughout the day. Cloudy skies, a high of 51. A chance of rain tonight as well, a low of 38. And then sunny and a high of 62 tomorrow.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting best-selling author and former lawyer Kristen Hanna, reading from her latest novel, Night Road, Tuesday evening, April 12th at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the so-called Parent Trigger Act. It's a provision already enacted in California and pending in the governor's proposed two-year state budget spending plan for Ohio. Joining us now is Heartland Institute Center for School Reform Director Bruno Behrendt. The Heartland Institute Center for School Reform is based in Chicago, and it favors such legislation. Welcome to the show, Bruno.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Some of the criticisms, there are lots of criticisms, which we'll get to, but tell me, what is the, why is it so important for parents to get involved at the administration of their local school at this level?
It's the one missing ingredient that has been lacking for decades. What we need in education is much more parental empowerment, more parental choice. The entire education reform movement for the last few decades, every single reform has been kind of absorbed, chewed on, and digested by the existing education bureaucracy. It's come at a very high cost. There's a great deal of payroll, a great deal of bloat, a great deal of spending, and it's the parents' wishes in terms of curriculum, in terms of quality of education for their children, that has been left lacking. It is time to start focusing on what the parents and the children want and need, and to pay much less attention to the existing education bureaucracy, which in the case of failing schools have, I think, lost their right or their the moral authority they have to continue churning a failed education product.
The parent trigger law has been touted as a necessary component for two-way conversation to build a genuine parent engagement in schools. That's long known to be a critical factor in almost any successful school, but the lack of a two-way conversation, but having something like a parent trigger law also has been called polarizing, that it works against the very idea of the two-way conversation.
I don't know that polarizing is necessarily even a bad thing. And in terms of parental empowerment, if you have all the power on one side of the equation, the district, the unions, the existing bureaucracy, the legislature who does what they want based on the bidding of the people who write their campaign checks, it's been a one-way conversation. If a two-way conversation makes things polarizing, I think it's important to bring it on. As I said, and I'll keep on coming back to it, it's time to start doing what the parents and the society and the taxpayers need and want done in terms of having an educated populace. And it's time to tell the existing system, you've had 40, 30, 50 years to get this right in these failing school environments, and you haven't done so.
I know, for instance, I want my kid to have more interaction with their teacher. I know he needs more interaction with the teachers, but the teachers are teaching classrooms, particularly in lower wealth areas, of upwards of the high 20s to the 30s and maybe even more. Kids in a classroom, maybe lots of kids who come from impoverished homes, lots of different conflicts in their lives. If I want more, how am I going to get that just by saying I want it? I mean, does that necessarily make what I want the right thing or the logical thing?
It's a good question. One of the more important things to look at in parent trigger or parent empowerment legislation is to see what the specific options are, and then to advise parents, quite frankly, and talk to them about what the best options could be. So if you have a school that's failing and the district infrastructure isn't getting it right, if they want to work on another five-year plan or rearranging the deck chairs on that school, you go to the parents and you say, here are the options that you have. So the drafting of the parent figure legislation should call for if you're going to call for charter conversions, you have to call for quality charters and to have a quality control mechanism in place so that the charter schools that are coming in are proven or operating under an operator that's proven. So that's the way you answer those questions, is you get specific and you say, here's the way to improve this school.
Bruno, my guest, by the way, is Bruno Behrendt. He is director of the Center for School Reform at the Heartland Institute, or I should say the Heartland Institute Center for School Reform. When you say that they already have a track record, by and large, that involves a for-profit entity that's operating independently. Doesn't the whole legislative or this entire process favor organizations like that? And in fact, in California, one of the big criticisms has been that the backers of this, the people that triggered the petition in the first place are related to and backers of charter school businesses?
Well, some charter school management organizations, there are some for-profit organizations out there. There are also, I would imagine, most charter operators and authorizers are nonprofits. So it really isn't about profit or nonprofit. It's about the charter or the contract that the new organization writes with the district or writes with the state or whoever's authorizing charters. And they say, we will promise to educate these children in this fashion. And if the state charter authorizer, whether it's a university or whether it's the state charter commission, it's a contract that they have to meet. And I think that it's important. We hear a lot of ideological banter back and forth about profit and nonprofit and for-profit. The fact is that you're saying, are you going to educate these children for this amount of money under this contract or under this charter? And if they succeed, then you've got a better school. You've got a better option.
We're talking about the parent trigger law. It's a proposal in Governor Kasich's two-year state spending plan for Ohio. The legislation would allow parents to take over failing schools and implement any of a number of reforms, including a charter school. If you have a question or comment, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. To our listeners, we'd like you to tell us if you think parents and guardians should have more say about the operations of the public schools their children attend or could attend. And tell us whether you support ideas like the parent trigger law. That's 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And joining us now is Ohio House Assistant Minority Whip Debbie Phillips. She represents the 92nd House District in the Athens area. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
One of the criticisms of the law in California, elsewhere, and including Ohio, is that how vague the language is. Is that anything that you're concerned about at this point, or is it just the larger concept?
That is certainly a concern. I want to back up just a second to say absolutely we want accountability, and no one wants to make excuses for chronically failing schools. But the majority of our public schools in Ohio are performing well and preparing students for a 21st century economy. If you look at the performance records, the public schools are performing better than the charter schools. So given that fact, to open up broadly across the state what your earlier speaker talked about as a last-minute cobbled-together proposal is troubling. We had Jean Harris, superintendent of Columbus Public Schools, testify in committee last week about the steps that Columbus Public has gone through under existing law to close or reconstitute schools that are not performing well. And she, in fact, offered Columbus Public to serve as a pilot for the parent trigger so that we could get some data, so that we could look at any operational glitches that could come up and try to take a serious look at the policy before rolling it out statewide.
Some people say that when you talk about pilots, that's just another nice way of saying you're going to bury it, the concept, for a while, and it's never really going to be tested in all the different kinds of environments it needs to be tested in.
Well, I just think you should look at the actual language that's in there and see the lack of clarity. We could end up in drawn-out court battles that aren't helping anybody, not any parents, not any students. In Compton, it looks like they not only allow parents to sign the petition, but future parents. I don't know how you even define a future parent in the district. And if there are interested parties coming in from the outside to circulate the petitions, and they can get parents of current charter school students or voucher school students to sign, and it may not even be the parents of students who are enrolled in the school. I think there are some real questions about accountability. We have elections. People vote for school boards, and to have an outside group come in and start meddling in what's happening in the school without a clear process, without a clear definition of who can sign the petition and how, in fact, we verify that those are parents, I just think it's ill-defined.
Well, and another question might be, should it just be the parents? Doesn't everybody in the district, particularly when it's funded by property taxes, have a vested interest in how the schools are managed? Bruno Behrend, what do you say to that?
I would be a very, very strong supporter of expanding the parent trigger idea into a citizen trigger. I agree 100% that it's not just the parents. The parents are the biggest stakeholders in this situation, or they should be viewed as the most important stakeholders whose needs need to be met. But from the standpoint of society, the ability to put a petition on a ballot or a referendum on a ballot to flip a failing school into a improved or a potentially improved product is one of the things that's been long past due. As far as the other issue having to do with the vagueness, that can be very easily cleaned up in drafting. And I think the other point to address as well is that the way the California law works is that any public school that is feeding into a failed school, I think it's fair to say that those parents have a stake in that as well. So I don't necessarily know that it's true that outside parents or parents from the outside schools, if you're inside a district or inside a school cluster where the top of that cluster, perhaps the high school, is failing, then that the parents whose kids are going to be going to that school should have a say in that as well. And I think that it's time, and I'll say this very quickly, it's time that we flipped the entire focus and the entire allocation dynamic in education, and we have to be much, much less concerned about the powerful financial interests that have developed in having their hands in the till of the education dollars that's flowing into these districts and put it in the hands of the parents.
Isn't that what the idea of a local school board is, though? It takes out of local school boards don't run with big campaign war chests. They're people in the neighborhood. They're people in the community that are voted for by people who live in that school district. Isn't that what that's all about?
It is, except for the fact that it operates primarily in theory. Your listeners who are listening to this show and people across Illinois, Ohio, across the country, they understand how difficult it is to actually change things at the school board level. The parents in Compton and LAUSD, where this came from, they have been trying to impact the school boards forever. in large districts, such as here in Chicago, you have Ron Huberman. He comes in, he tries to fix the schools. The system always knows how to wait out the reformers. It's happened in D.C., it's happened in Seattle, it's happened in L.A. At the smaller school district level, we all know that whether it's an off-year election or whether it's a November election, mm-hmm. the people who are most interested, the people who have a stake in the finances of the issue, are the ones that usually control school board races. So would it be wonderful to get a reform board mm-hmm. that was able to change things? It's great in theory, but show me where it's happened.
Representative Phillips, absolutely. We don't get to respond.
The reference to citizens petitioning to place an issue on the ballot, I find very interesting, given the fact that this language spells out a petition to be signed by parents, and then those are supposed to be certified by the school district treasurer, and a parent could then appeal if they disagree to the county auditor. That's a very different process from the process to put an issue on the ballot, where we know, in fact, who the voters are, and there is an established body of law about determining who votes. And that's part of the point that I'm trying to make about the vagueness here in the drafting. So if, in fact, this is something that people want to put forth, it would seem to be helpful to have a clear definition of the process and how it works so that we don't end up mired in years of litigation. And I also want to circle back to Dr. Harris's testimony from last week. She described three schools, East Haven Elementary School, Champion Middle School, and the Lyndon McKinley feeder pattern, that have been reconstituted under current law, under provisions that require school districts to take those steps if there are chronically underperforming schools. They have three additional schools slated to be reconstituted next fall. So there is a process in place in current law because we can't accept chronic failure for any of our students. This issue of the parent trigger, opening this up statewide without a clear process and without clear guidelines, is a recipe for chaos.
Why can't they just work it out, say, in rules committee or something like that?
They could.
Representative Phillips?
I have not heard any openness to discussion. Certainly we will be providing amendments. I would prefer to remove this provision from the budget or to look at the pilot that was offered by Dr. Harris, but certainly we will also be offering amendments to try to bring greater clarity should it go through anyway.
We have to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about parent triggers. It's a effort or it's a proposal in the governor's two-year state budget plan that would give parents more power to control the makeup of their local school and how it's operated. We'll get to our calls and we'll get to our emails when we return. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Chaos in North Africa.
Tanks, helicopters, and military aircraft have reportedly been used indiscriminately to attack the protesters.
Government gunmen fired on protesters after Friday prayers.
There is an enormous fury here that the leader of this country has turned the guns on his own people.
The quest for democracy turns violent. NPR News is there.
On 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll hear powerful stories of challenges faced by at-risk pregnant women in the developing world with documentary filmmaker Christy Turlington Burns. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11 here on 89.7 NPR News. And WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's Success Embraces Diverse Audiences, featuring Michael Daniels of Outlook Media. Tickets and more information at columbusmetroclub.org. Currently 44 degrees in downtown Columbus, a chance of rain throughout the day, cloudy skies, and a high of 51. There's a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 38 degrees, a nicer day tomorrow, sunny skies and a high of 62. Partly cloudy Wednesday night and a low of 42. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about a proposal in Ohio that would allow parents to petition a school district to make reforms in a school that for a certain amount of time is ranked in the lowest 5% of all district operated schools statewide. The parents may request reopening the school as a charter operation, replacing most of the personnel, contracting with another district to operate the school, or they could turn the school over to the Department of Education or any other major restructuring that makes fundamental reforms in the school's staffing or governance. Bruno Behrend of the Heartland Institute Center for School Reform, that's a pretty tall order for a bunch of parents that just want to make sure their kids get a decent education. I mean, how do parents get together and coalesce in a way that makes sense for a group of people? The fact is they're not experts on education. They don't know all of the different factors that go into a classroom education process. Where's that structure coming from?
It's a good question, and the answer is in the legislation. If you turn around and say that you have to use this source of quality charters, or if the parents get, let's say the parents get together and say, hey, we know we're not experts, but we have been empowered by this new law to go and seek some answers, and they go and talk to a few superintendents or they talk to a few charter operators, they can get some answers very quickly. I think that it's very important for us to look at the flip side of your question. We're always sitting there saying, well, the parents aren't qualified, they're not experts. Well, we've been dumping money into large districts, medium-sized districts, suburban districts, which have a different socioeconomic status, therefore mm-hmm. they have different results. And we have been having an education problem in this country for decades. And we've been doing that by giving money to the so-called experts in the existing system. So what I think is important here, and why I think it's important that laws like this get a very strong look, is that it's time to challenge that system. It's time to say, you know what, you've had a lot of time and a lot of money to get this right, and you haven't done it, so now we're going to turn it over to a broader array of people. And is every single one of those options going to be perfect or work perfectly? The answer is no. But in comparison with the existing system, the chances that it operates better and certainly closer to home with the parents having more being more empowered, I think it's something that is it's definitely overdue.
Representative Phillips, there has been a lot of concern for many years that parents just are not empowered, that the administration, that the institutions keep asking parents to get more involved, but when they try to really get involved, there's a lot of pushback.
Well, certainly it's beneficial for everybody if parents are involved in their children's education. I think that one of the issues that we have to wrestle with when we're talking about public education is that, you know, we have a constitutional obligation to provide educational opportunities to all students, regardless of whether they come from a supportive home environment or not. We need to have opportunities available so that those students have a chance to live the American dream and develop their talents. I think that there's been a lot of focus on areas where the system is not producing the results that we want, but in fact, there are many schools where public schools are producing good results and are supporting young people as they develop as citizens and future leaders and business leaders. We also have in Ohio some problems with the way the charter school law is currently constituted. Under Ohio law, if a charter school is persistently failing, there is a provision to close that school. And yet, at Paul Lawrence Dunbar in Toledo, the school was closed because they were failing and reopened under a new name with the same management company, the same administration, the same sponsor, in the same building with almost all of the same teachers. So that's one of the things that's currently happening in a charter school in the state of Ohio, which is held out as some sort of panacea to solve the problems in our educational system. We've got real problems to solve, but you can't just say that, you know, throw it all out and start over when we do have some good results.
Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes. My question is, where does all this leave the taxpayer who doesn't have any kids in school anymore? People can take their voucher money, they can go to charter schools, and that money's lost to the school system, and yet I still have to sit there and pay my taxes, and I can't take my money and give it to a school that I think is performing better. Let's say I live in Baltimore, so the closest schools to us are like Liberty Christian or Fisher Catholic, or maybe kid wants to go to Columbus Academy, and I think that's a better school to send my money to. It still leaves the taxpayer footing the bill for what's left over after the cream gets skimmed off the top.
Bruno?
Boy, I'd love to it's an excellent point, and it's important to understand that taxpayers do have a stake in this. Any citizen who wants to fund a different school or what they think is a better option, there should be some form of tax credit or there should be some form of opportunity for them to do so. Now, they do get a tax deduction at the federal level and probably at the state level as well. But it's important to understand that there's more to this education system than simply the people who are inside the certification bubble, the administration bubble, the district bubble, and all of this infrastructure that has been absorbing all the resources, and their panacea has been to say, just give us more and we'll try to do better.
A lot of districts would say to that that we've been legislated to death. A lot of these bubbles that are created weren't by their, they didn't create them. The legislators created them in the first place.
It's a fair point, and I would be more than happy to completely, what's the best word for it, deregulate. And if districts work the way they should work, where they were actually local units of government free to do what they wanted to do to educate their children, I think we'd see a much better education system in this country. However, we've got race to the top. We've got No Child Left Behind. We've got state mandates. We've got internal political fiefdom.
All of which is linked to funding from the federal level, funding from the state level.
Exactly.
Representative Phillips?
And I would add, if you look at No Child Left Behind, I heard Congressman Miller talk about the reason that that legislation was initiated, and it was because there were students who were not being served, because there were special needs students who were essentially being, you know, just stored away out of sight. And there, we have a constitutional obligation to provide an education to all of the students, regardless of their educational needs, their behavioral issues, where they come from. That is one of those core foundational principles in our country, that all children have that opportunity to be able to develop as citizens.
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, this is a much bigger issue than having just pulling a trigger, because there's a lot more to the California educational school system than you could even get into at this. I'll just say Proposition 13 and leave it at that. My big concern is that, Kasich is taking away what little leverage the school, the educators have, and then taking away even more by offering more and more school vouchers. And none of these things have been tested or finalized. As was mentioned, the charter schools here vary. I've actually subbed in a couple of them. And with No Child Left Behind, you know, this is supposed to be being done in the best interest of the child. But with No Child Left Behind, all the kids are being tested to death, and none of this is going into their best interest.
Okay.
So, you know, you've got all children left behind. And just to make a final point, our lovely new governor doesn't even have his kids in his public school area, which is one of the best public school systems in Ohio. He's got his kids going to a private school.
Which is slated to close because of the budget cuts in this governor's budget. I would just add, as a member of the Finance Committee, that it has been wildly frustrating trying to get enough information to begin to do our job in relation to this budget. There are a lot of policy proposals in here that are fairly broadly laid out and very little data to dig into to propose any responsible amendments.
Well, and as a matter of public policy, it's a better thing to do to have a transparent process so everybody can be involved in it.
You agree then that that's a problem in the California process?
Well, actually, here's what I find fascinating.
Where I want to reiterate for our listeners, where they were collecting the or having the petition signed quietly, privately, without any public discussion or conversation.
Well, let's be clear that the myth of the benign, happy, wonderful school district with a supportive board who loves all of the citizens, that's a myth. This was a
I would
powerful,
agree.
This is a powerful bureaucracy that was going to stomp on the head of anybody
you talk
who was
about
daring to challenge it.
Bruno, you talk about a powerful bureaucracy, but I'll go back to the issue of these people are not operating from huge war chests. What do you mean by a powerful bureaucracy when you're talking about a local school board?
Look at any school district, whether it's a well-funded suburban district with property tax wealth or whether it gets a lot of money from the state and it's an urban or ex-urban district. Every school district is a little mini corporation, although it doesn't have any shareholders. It's run by a school code. It's run by bureaucracies, and the people inside that bureaucracy have powerful financial interests. Let's not pretend that there aren't associations of school boards who have a jobs machine they're working. Let's not pretend that there aren't teachers' unions who have a specific powerful interest in keeping the system the way it is so that the money keeps flowing in the direction
likewise,
that it's flowing.
Critics of the parent trigger law in California and around the country have said that there's a vested interest for for-profit charter schools to push the parent trigger laws. How are parents ever to know who's behind what? I mean, no one is free from suspicion.
I'm a big fan of transparency, and I don't think there's anything wrong with philanthropists who want to improve the education system, and I don't think there's anything wrong with people openly debating that they'll give the existing system one more chance. Let's have that debate, and let's have transparency as to who's behind things. But let's change the dynamic in the favor of the parents. And one other thing that bears well, you sound like you want to ask a question. I wanted to.
Well, I wanted Representative Phillips to.
I have to say, in reference to transparency, that there's a lot of money being spent in Ohio by charter school interests in elections. There have been campaign finance violations in recent years, and there are still struggles to try to tease out who is behind some of the independent expenditure campaigns that have gone on in recent years. So I think that transparency is a wonderful goal, and I think that there are clearly vested interests who are trying to undermine the public education system, which is here to provide opportunity for all of our kids, and we must keep fighting to make it better. But there are vested interests who are trying to undermine that system with a profit motive.
Rich from East Columbus, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. This is going to be real quick. I have a comment for the representative and a comment for Bruno. First off, Bruno, I just want to commend you and thank you. You are right on point. I'm a product of an inner city single parent household who went through the educational system here in Columbus, Ohio, been to prison. I look back at my transcripts, dismal failure, D's, F's, C's, all through my junior high up till high school. I didn't go to college till I went to prison. A's and B's. This system has got to change. Representative, I don't know who you're representing, but it sure ain't the urban community here in Columbus, Ohio, or anywhere else, because the things you're saying is the same old, it's not working. You can't keep hitting your head against the wall and think you're going to get through it. You're just going to get a bleeding head. So this has to change. Bruno, you're right on point, man. Thank you,
Rich, from East Columbus. And, Bruno?
Rich, thank you. I just want to say this. I don't think there's a problem here with people working together to improve the system. A constitutional duty to educate everybody doesn't mean that we have to create 1,000 school districts or 45 school districts, and everything has to be run through this one school code, and everything has to be run through these administrators and these unions and these powerful people. We can have a constitutional education system where the money follows the child to a vast new array of education resources, and that will serve everybody's community. It's not just about rich or poor or profit or nonprofit. It's about the best way to educate somebody.
Representative Phillips?
I think that it's important to make sure that there are going to be opportunities there for all of the kids, and this the effort that's underway to undermine public schools strips resources away from the students who need the most help. There, if you have students leaving to attend a voucher school, that school doesn't have to accept students who have a greater educational need or behavioral problems or a lack of support at home. They're allowed to make their own decisions about which students to accept, leaving the students who need the most help in a public system that has been stripped of its resources, and that is not helpful to our overall community. If kids don't get the opportunities they need, as our previous caller indicated, they may end up involved with the criminal justice system, costing us far more in the long run.
And I guess the one response I'd have to that very quickly is that it's time to rethink this. It's not about money following the system, and it's not about whether money leaves the district. It's time to wonder whether we even need something like a school district, and it's time to start thinking about the money following the child. And the minute the money follows the child, this whole argument about the system and the inputs into the system changes to what is the best way to meet the needs of this specific child, and that can be done without the existing 50-year-old 19th century bureaucracy.
We're just about out of time. Representative Phillips?
I would continue to say we need a lot more information about how any of these policy changes in the budget would actually operate in the real world. There's a lot of high-flown rhetoric in here and a lot of questions about what it would mean for real-life parents and real-life children, and we need to get some real answers before moving forward with anything like this.
Well, as usual, anytime we talk about anything to do with schools, it ends up being a very wide-ranging discussion. I want to thank my guests today for helping us focus a little bit on the proposed parent trigger law in Ohio. Bruno Behrendt, he is from the Heartland Institute Center for School Reform. Bruno, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
And also Representative Debbie Phillips. She is from the 92nd District down there by Athens. Representative Phillips, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.